We'll start with Costanza versus Barnhart.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If it please the court, Mark Lipton for the appellant, Catherine Costanza. Having gone through many Social Security hearings where we have the experts testify by phone, I'm used to talking to the air and then hearing a response back. So, Judge Gibson, thank you for being here with us and taking the time to listen to my case. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. This is a Social Security disability appeal. I'm sure the Court's very familiar with the facts and have reviewed it all.
We have indeed.
I would like to just point out, on a policy basis, the issue here, of course, is a remand versus a reversal. When we have remands, we double everybody's time. We double the time of the administrative law judges, the appeals counsel, and the claimants. And while abuse of discretion under Harmon is the standard you're to use today, I certainly believe that the policy of having to have cases done twice when they don't have to be done twice for the inconvenience not only of the administration, but certainly the burden it puts on the claimants should be considered. The standard of review, as Harmon enunciates, is that the case should be reversed rather than remanded if the ALJ has failed to provide legally sufficient reasons for rejecting the evidence, there are no outstanding issues to be resolved, and it's clear from the record that the ALJ would be required to find the claimant disabled were such evidence credited. And I think that in this case, Ms. Costanza meets all those criteria. I think she illustrated that there were legal errors committed by the ALJ. The administrative law judge failed to credit her credibility properly, and the witness she presented, the district court agreed with that. The ALJ did not apply the proper rules to the treating physicians. The district court agreed with that as well. Were those things done properly? Were her testimony and the opinions of the treating physicians credited like they should have been? We have a lady who's limited to working maybe a couple of days a week. She testified that she has 4 bad days a week because of fibromyalgia, where she rests most of the day. We have a medical examiner who testified that he didn't know whether she had fibromyalgia or not, but if she did, her symptomology that she complained of would be consistent with the illness. Most compelling in this case, Your Honors, is not only the opinion of Dr. Levitz, the treating physician, but the treatment he gave her since April of 1992, and his records are in the transcript. Trigger point injections of cortisone every other month, year after year after year. This isn't a case where he sent her just a biofeedback or prescribed Elavil, which is a typical treatment for fibromyalgia, and told her to do a little bit of aerobic exercise. This is a situation where he's doing probably the most invasive treatment you can do for fibromyalgia. So he took it quite seriously, and she went to him year after year after year. The issues that the commissioner raises as unresolved issues are the onset date and the need for possible vocational testimony. As to the onset date, the record does not have to be unequivocal. In fact, I believe it's Social Security ruling 8320 even indicates that precise evidence need not be available. Inferences are even permissible. Well, in this case, we have a lady that started with surgery in June of 1991 for her neck, went on to bilateral carpal tunnel surgery for her hands, and then only after those did not resolve with her symptomology did the fibromyalgia diagnosis attach, and treatment began for that. Again, Social Security ruling 83-20 indicates that to determine the onset, you start with the applicant's allegations. And the ruling actually says this is found on the disability.
September 30th, 96 is the key date here?
September 30th, 96 is the date last insured, Your Honors.
Right.
So back in June 1991 was the last date she actually worked. And again, the Social Security ruling indicates that as far as the applicant's allegations, you start with the application. And the alleged onset date in her application is June 1991. Then you look at work history, and you do that by looking at the earnings report, which is also in the record, which ends in that third quarter of 1991. And then you look at the medical and other evidence. Well, since June 1991, this applicant, this claimant, has had one procedure after another trying to treat chronic symptomology. And she has had the treatment not only of surgeries, and they post her date last insured, she had multiple gastrointestinal surgeries, bowel resections, and she started with those actually prior to her date last insured. But the fibromyalgia, which was first picked up and diagnosed in 1992, was treated since April of 92 with trigger point injections. Her testimony is credited if the opinions of Dr. Levitz and Dr. Restifo and Dr. Kaufman, that if she had fibromyalgia, these would be the symptoms which she complained of, which are significant fatigue, joint pain, needing to rest multiple days a week, are credited, there are no outstanding issues.
Did Kaufman think that she didn't have fibromyalgia?
He said he didn't know. My cross-examination of him ended with, "Been sitting here today, Dr. Kaufman, you don't have an opinion one way or the other whether this lady has fibromyalgia." And he said, "Right." So, but he said, "But if she had it, her symptoms would be appropriate." But he says, "That's what they say." Dr. Kaufman is not very partial to the diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Well, the vapors, right?
The vapors. I've been with him on several hearings, and I understand it. And I understand this court's dilemma with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, when we don't have a lot of objective evidence. But, again, you look at the whole record with this lady. This is not somebody who just waltzes into a doctor one day. You know, so I think the record speaks for itself. I do not believe the vocational testimony is necessary because the rulings make it clear she can't do sedentary work at all. That's the lowest level because that requires 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. So
is there an issue of what from what time she is entitled to compensation?
I don't believe the onset date is an issue. She stopped working June 1991. That's when she had her first neck surgery. That's what she put on her application, and the earnings records indicate she never worked past that date. And Dr. Levitz, who was her primary treating physician, indicates since that date, the neck surgery, she's been disabled, that you know, she's totally disabled, she can't sustain activity, she's in chronic pain, and I think that is the date.
Just to clarify, though, I understood that the key has to be before the 96 date, September.
Exactly,
it has to be. Now, does it also have to be precise as to actual onset, or is enough of it just occurred before 96?
Well, for her to be eligible, if it occurred before 1996, she's covered and she gets benefits. The question is, how much retroactive benefits
exactly
would she get?
So that has to be determined. It's important for you to take it back to 91 to get the full benefits during the pre-96 period.
Well, it is and it isn't, because her application date, that's probably the only fact I don't have is her application date, but they're only going to pay her 1 year back behind her application, and she didn't file in 92.
Okay.
So even if you found that.
When did she file? You don't know.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Why don't you save your time for rebuttal,
and you
can tell us that.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Ryan, and I represent the Social Security Administration. I'm Assistant Regional Counsel here in the San Francisco office. And I would like to add on a personal note that it is a very great privilege and honor to be here appearing before this court today. Mr. Lipton started out by telling the court that this is a policy issue and reminding the court that it was a remand versus reversal issue, and I would like to redirect the court's attention to the policy involved here. The basic standard of review that this court has before it is, did the district court abuse its discretion? This court is not engaging in a de novo review of the evidence. This court simply takes what the district court found and determines whether it's an abuse of discretion under Harmon versus Apfel and other cases that the court is familiar with. The policy.
That's different from the usual situation where we're reviewing de novo, because this is a remand versus a determination.
Yes, sir. It's because the question that the appeal brought by the claimant was not attacking the determination of the district court to remand the case. That would have been a de novo review. The appeal was brought attacking the remedy fashioned in that remand, whether it should have been to order the commissioner to make immediate payment of benefits versus conduct additional proceedings in order to cure defects that we ourselves admitted had occurred at the administrative hearing level. And that is the policy that I ask the court to keep in mind. The very doctrine of separation of powers.
Well, without, if we understand, I think, the role here. I think the abuse of discretion issue, at least as I understand it, would be that, and is at least being argued by the claimant here, is that if you accept and properly credit the testimony and evidence that was improperly addressed by the ALJ, is there anything left as a matter of law? And what's left? I mean, if in fact you credit the testimony that she can't work 4 days out of a week, what's left to argue about here, factually?
I believe appellant is asking this court to credit as true evidence that the district court chose not to credit as true.
Well, but under our law, don't we credit as a matter of law the unrefuted or the improperly rejected testimony?
No, sir. Most of the cases in which treating physician opinions have been rejected by the ALJ or in which the claimant's credibility has been rejected by the ALJ are indeed remanded for further proceedings rather than remanded for immediate payment of benefits. In fact, Judge Reinhart himself has made such rulings. The bulk of the cases dealing with the credits.
Why Judge Reinhart himself?
Well, because, shall we call him the father of the rule? Judge Reinhart in Nguyen remanded for further proceedings in a credit as true case rather than for immediate payment of benefits. And the reason is, of course, as the case law developed, it's not just a question of do we accept as true the physician's evidence or the claimant's evidence, but also we look at what that evidence is and ask, does that compel a conclusion of disability?
Why doesn't that here?
Well, we have some countervailing facts. Contrary to claimant's claim, it's not clear from the record that she quit working in June of 91 because she testified that she kept working until about June of 92, that she was working even after she had her carpal tunnel surgery.
What difference would that make?
The onset,
whether it's 91 or 92.
The onset date is important, and yes, it is important to fix an exact month of onset from the standpoint of if she is determined to be eligible for benefits, then the question is from what date does she get paid the benefits? So it's relevant not just to...
She can't be paid for more than 1 year back from the time she filed.
1 year? I believe it's 1 year, Your Honor. I'm sorry. That's just fled my mind.
That's what opposing counsel said. So it would be, if, for example, she filed in 1994, wouldn't make much difference whether she quit working in 92 or 91.
Well, that issue goes to credibility, and that issue goes to severity of symptoms. If she is alleging one thing, but she testifies to another, for example, she kept bowling until 1993, and that's hardly consistent with disability and inability to work from 1991. These are factual questions which should properly be resolved by the adjudicator, which in this case is the administrative law judge. And that's why I believe the district court ordered a remand for further proceedings, because there are a number of questions about the onset date.
Is there any question that she's disabled now?
I can't tell you as of to date, but I can tell you that at the time the ALJ wrote his decision, the ALJ determined that claimant finally became disabled. And the question was, did it occur before or after the date last insured?
Right. Right.
And so that's the question that has to be resolved on further proceedings.
Okay. Judge Gibson, any questions?
No questions.
Thank you.
I do have one more. I'm having a hard time with this, and maybe it's because we don't know the dates on which she filed. But if the ALJ said, yeah, she's disabled now, and we're looking back from 96, 1 year or 2 years, it seems to me that makes a big difference, because it seemed pretty obvious she's disabled now, and she's not going to get better from all of this. So we're...
Well, the ALJ said that in 1998, and the critical date is September of 96, when
September,
her insurance ran out.
Yeah, but...
So
you haven't said anything about anything in 96. You talk about bowling up till 1993. What is there to suggest she wasn't disabled before 1996?
Actually, there is almost a dearth of any kind of events striking this poor lady between 1994 and 96. And then 96 becomes important because that's when she had her partial colon surgery. And the ALJ determined that she had a temporary period of disability following that in order to have reasonable recuperation, but it was not until a year and a half after that it became apparent that she was really going to have considerable procedures done.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I'll make this brief because I have to. We do meet the harm and abuse of discretion standard, Your Honor. I cited that when I first began speaking. According to the commissioner, this court can never order a reversal if a district court has ordered a remand, and that's not the case. You do have authority to reverse a case. The application actually was filed on February 18, 1997. So as far as her back benefits go, if the court wanted to take a June 1992 onset, it wouldn't really affect the issue very much.
What was that date again?
February 18th, 1997. Your Honor, the statement about her testimony and her credibility is very frustrating because, first of all, the district court found that she was credible, contrary to what the commissioner is arguing. But what the sequence of events are is we had our hearing in 1998, and by that time, the court is well aware what this lady had gone through in 1998. And whether she was confused when she said June of 1992 rather than 1991, or she meant that she wanted her employer to consider her off the rolls, really is, if you look at the entire record, her surgeries began in 1991. She had no earnings past 1991. And her application says June 1991. So she gets at the hearing and she says June 1992. To say this creates a big credibility issue is very, very silly.
Am I correct then that the back benefits would only be due from, providing it's found that she's disabled, would only be from February 18th of 1996?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's the key issue, is it not, whether she was disabled? Of course, before the September date in 1996, but for past benefits, it would be February 18th of 1996.
That's correct. And the only other point I want to raise is in response to the allegation that there wasn't much going on as far as, you know, pain or problems up until, you know, this 1996 and the colon resections. This is the way the administrative law judge handled it. He disregarded the fibromyalgia, and he focused on the bowel resections and those items. Mm-hmm. And I'm here saying her fibromyalgia was so severe that in April of 1992, after this neck surgery didn't relieve her problems, after the bilateral carpal tunnel surgery didn't relieve her problems, her treating physician, Dr. Levitz, began trigger point injections every other month since April of 1992, which also belies the June of 92 stopping work date. It was June of 91 she stopped work. Her earnings record, her application, Dr. Levitt's report, all support June of 1991. If the court found June of 1992, I wouldn't have an issue with it. It's inconsequential. But she's been very consistent, and she had significant treatment starting in 1992 on her fibromyalgia, and that's what this issue is in this case. Do we credit her fibromyalgia or not? And I can't see how we can disregard it, given the opinions of the treating physicians, the lack of any clear and convincing evidence against them, as is required in Light, Lester, Reddick, and this whole plethora of cases that we've had.
So if I understand correctly, it did seem to me that the ALJ was basing it largely on the fact that he disbelieved that fibromyalgia was a
disabling condition.
Disease. And I guess that's what Dr. Kaufman was saying was the vapors.
Yeah, he doesn't know what it is. He can't put his arms around it. He's not comfortable with it. But if she has it, those symptoms are what they say that people have.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case just argued will be submitted. Thank counsel for their argument. Next case is Bankston versus White. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court. Justice Gibson in absentia, but here via phone. My name is Jeffrey Dickerson. I'm from Reno, Nevada. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Bankston, who is a federal employee who was dismissed from federal service, after which he filed an appeal with the MSPB. He also alleged that age discrimination was involved with his termination, and therefore it became a mixed case with the MSPB. Prior to the administrative hearing with the ALJ, he withdrew his or requested withdrawal of his MSPB, doing that directly to the ALJ, who in turn granted that request, allowed the withdrawal, and canceled the hearing, whereupon Mr. Bankston proceeded to file in a timely fashion, in other words, within 90 days, in Federal District Court in Reno, Nevada. What ensued was a motion to dismiss initially on that case, which we'll call Bankston 1, in which they moved to dismiss based upon a failure to exhaust grounds. That culminated in a colloquy between counsel and the court, whereupon Judge McKibben ordered us to have 90 days in which to attempt to reopen that matter and then come back to him if advise him if we had been able to reopen it. If we couldn't reopen it, then he'd address the issue that was presented at that point in time. We attempted to reopen it. The MSPB would not allow us to reopen it, so we did come back to Judge McKibben, and the issue was again presented. The procedural posture within which it was presented happened to be a renewed action because he dismissed the previous action without prejudice to bring a second action, and there was no issue regarding limitations periods due to that order. The district court considered the new briefing. Did not have, I don't believe, subsequent arguments. I'm sure that the district court considered the transcript because it ordered the transcript on the previous hearing and then made a decision. And the decision was not based upon, nor did it address, the question that was left open in Stevens versus the Department of Treasury. And that question is whether or not, under the ADEA, a federal employee is required to exhaust his administrative remedies. Our position in this appeal and down below was that, as Justice Stevens, in his concurring opinion, indicated, that there was no exhaustion requirement in the ADEA, and therefore, a fortiori, you could not have an abandonment argument to apply as a prudential consideration by the courts, grafting something into the legislation that wasn't there. Administratively, you may have regulations under these cases that address this issue, and under the regulation that was addressed below by Judge McKibben, which is 29 CFR 1614, that's a regulation. And Judge McKibben solely addressed the regulation. He did not address whether or not the ADEA, the statute that Congress created this remedy under, addressed whether or not a final agency decision was necessary in order to proceed to federal court. And as indicated in Justice Stevens' concurring opinion in Stevens versus the Department of Treasury, what as he saw it, what the courts that have gone this way, the Third Circuit, the First Circuit in Castro, I believe the Third Circuit in Petrel, these other cases that have been cited in the briefs and in the decision below, have grafted upon this statutory scheme an analogy, or by analogy, a requirement similar to that in Title VII, where there is none that exists. And the only circuit that's out there that really has candidly addressed this issue, I think, is the Sixth Circuit in Langford. And they looked at it and they said there is nothing there to require a final agency decision under the ADEA.
Does it make a difference if the action is still pending at the time that the civil action is brought?
That issue isn't here, thank goodness, because in the BAC decision, which they argue is not applicable anymore, but there is a part in that BAC decision at the very last paragraph. They say that the primary purpose of the exhaustion requirement is to prevent simultaneous proceedings. And I would imagine that if that issue were presented to you, you would have some serious prudential concerns because you're double tracking it. And in that instance, it's not here, though. Fortunately for this Court, it doesn't have to address that issue. That would raise some serious concerns prudentially. In this case,
EEOC there was, as I recall, there was in the earlier I forget the date it was amended, but it was amended so that if the petitioner filed or the claimant filed a civil action, that automatically terminated the pending proceeding?
Right. Yeah. And in this particular case, for instance, in the Vinietros case, which is a Ninth Circuit case where they applied the abandonment doctrine, and that case doesn't apply here. I mean, that case, you've got that guy going every which way but loose, Your Honor. You know, he files an MSPB, then he files an EEOC, and he does several other things before he finally gets to federal court. But in that case, what happened was he filed with the MSPB and then filed with the EEOC, and you can't have both. And so that's another situation where you would have some serious prudential considerations at play, where you've got a complaining party, a charging party, attempting to dual-track things and get two bites at the apple, essentially. We didn't get two bites at the apple here. We decided, when I got involved with the case, and I don't know if this is in the record, but just so you know, I became involved, and I did not want to go to that hearing. I did not want this adjudicated by the administrative law judge, and I advised the client that we could get out of this. I reviewed the case law with respect to this, and I knew this issue was going to come up. I was almost certain that it was going to come up, and here we are today addressing it. We're not addressing it because I'm concerned about my potential problem in advising the client to drop that. We're addressing this because it's an important issue. And the question, I think, really comes down to, can this court look, as the court below did, look at a regulation that the EEOC has promulgated that says here are the three avenues you have to go, and you can't go to federal court until 180 days expires in the EEOC process or 120 days expires with the MSPB process, and then you can treat that as a final agency decision, and only then can you go to federal court where the Congress has not imposed any such limitation. Where Congress has imposed such a limitation, the courts have been correct in coming down and applying as a prudential consideration the requirement that if you undertake to exhaust your administrative remedies and abandon them, you're stuck. But in this situation, you don't have that. And therefore, by imposing that prudential consideration in this case, under these facts, this Court is grafting a prudential requirement or a limitation where Congress has not even spoken. And I think that would be inappropriate for this Court to undertake that type of judicial legislating where Congress has been silent. And we know that where Congress has wanted to speak about the issue, it has done so. It has done so very clearly under 2000E16, Title VII, requiring exhaustion, requiring a final agency decision to be made before you proceed to federal court. It has not done so in the ADEA, and certainly not with respect to federal employees.
You say that Judge McKibben relied on the regulation. What does the regulation say about that?
Well, as I recall the regulation, it's somewhat detailed, but it says that you can, as a federal employee.
Oh, on this particular issue, we don't have to get into all the detail.
Oh, okay. On this particular issue?
Yeah.
Well, Judge McKibben canvassed it in a long paragraph as to what the different options were, what he did here, which is basically took the third option, went to the MSPB. And under the MSPB category, you've got 120. They have 120 days to deal with the issue, after which you can treat it as a final agency decision. Here on the 62nd day, we withdrew. Okay, so we didn't exhaust the 120. But I think it's curious if you look at, I believe, footnote 11. I saw this morning and thought it was curious that in the Viniatros case at footnote 11, they discussed the 120-day MSPB requirement because, remember, in that case, he had gone to the MSPB. And in the footnote, the court notes that the 120-day limitation is a fire under the agency's rear, if you will, and not any kind of effect upon a final agency decision. As I understand that footnote, what they're saying is, unlike the 180-day requirement the EEOC has imposed, after which you can treat it as a final agency decision, the Viniatros case is saying that's not what that is. 120 days does not make a final agency decision. Okay? So that's another distinction, and I haven't thought through how to, if it's even necessary, to try to figure that out, because, again, Congress has not required a final agency decision. Whether or not the 120 is a final agency decision or not is beside the point in this case. We did undertake in a timely fashion to trigger the procedures that were in place as Congress has required. We timely filed the action after concluding the administrative proceeding. And to say that we abandoned that proceeding and therefore didn't exhaust leaves this person without a remedy, and that's unfair, and it's not what Congress intended. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Judge Gibson, any questions?
No questions.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Greg Addington. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the District of Nevada in Reno. It would be very tempting to read the Supreme Court decision in Stevens and this Court's decision in Back and conclude that a age discrimination complainant need not proceed through any previously initiated administrative process before filing suit in district court. I would submit that that is superficially appealing, but it would be erroneous. There are two separate parallel statutory and regulatory schemes available for an age discrimination complainant. One is under Title 29 and the implementing regulations in 29 CFR, specifically 29 CFR 1614.201 and following. And on the other hand, there is another track under Title 5. The Title 29 process is described as the EEO process. Another process is the MSPB process under Title V, specifically Section 7702, and its implementing regulations found at 5 CFR, specifically 1201.151 and following. The District Court properly recognized that this is that Mr. Bankston initiated a mixed case under Title V, Section 7702, and its implementing regulations. Neither Stevens nor Back have anything to do with this case because the complainants in those two cases initiated EEO processes by filing a EEO complaint with their respective agencies. Those are not mixed case cases. Those are not MSPB cases. They are separate and distinct regulations with separate and distinct requirements. And this Court in Back made it very clear in footnote 1 at page 244 of that decision that it had nothing to do with anything other than EEO regulations, namely the Title 29 regulations. In footnote 1, it states, quote, "We emphasize that our holding is limited to age discrimination claims governed by EEOC regulations." And then there's a case citation following. This case, Bankston case, is not governed by the EEOC regulations. Back recognized, just as the Seventh Circuit in Adler had previously recognized, that the EEOC regulations included a provision which Your Honor Judge Hugg mentioned, namely 29 CFR 1614.409, that filing suit in the EEOC context terminates the Commission's processing of the appeal. And I say Commission processing of the appeal because that's what the regulation says. It only affects what the EEOC does because it would only be an EEOC matter that was pending in connection with those regulations.
Well, so the EEOC regimen is that, and the BAC was dealing with, now provides that if let's see. to the result of Regulation 1613.513 in effect at the time Back filed his complaint is to terminate any unexhausted administrative proceeding when a claimant files a civil suit. Similarly, an exhaustion requirement would terminate any civil suit filed. Thus, the joint effect of the amended regulations and exhaustion would be to leave the claimant without any avenue of relief.
That is correct.
Okay, so in the EEOC process, if the claimant terminates, or filed, rather, if the claimant files a parallel civil action, doesn't that terminate by the claimant's act?
Yes.
Okay, so in this case, the claimant effectively did just that. The claimant withdrew his claim before the MSPB.
He did.
Now, where is it writ that the claimant, having started down the MSPB road, must finish it to conclusion, when the MSPB, in fact, granted his request to dismiss?
Yes. Well, first of all, we must note that under the Title V regime and the 5 CFR regime pertinent to mixed cases, right, there is no counterpart to the regulation in the EEOC.
Well, but there's also no exhaustion requirement as a counterpart to Title VII, is there?
Yes, indeed there is. Under Title V, 7702.
Title VII has a statutory exhaustion requirement, doesn't it?
Title VII has the statutory exhaustion requirement built into it. Yes, sir.
Is there one for MSPB, Title
V? Yes. Title V.
Congress specified exhaustion of remedies.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would note, Title V of 7702 begins with one of my very favorite introductory phrases, notwithstanding any other provision of law, and then it goes on to state that a mixed case complainant who files a petition with the MSPB is before that board, and the board, quote, must decide that appeal within 120 days, or must decide.
What does that say about exhaustion of remedies, though? That's not the, does that parallel the language in Title VII?
Well, it does.
That's what you're reading into it, and that's what Judge McKibben understood it to be saying, but that doesn't say anything about that the petitioner, having brought it, must exhaust that. It just says that's a time frame in which MSPB must act.
Yes.
It's sort of like the California Supreme Court has to get its decisions out 60 days in submission or they don't get paid. But that doesn't mean, I mean, that's what you're reading into it, though, that that's a congressional exhaustion requirement.
That is the congressional exhaustion requirement. That's correct. The board must decide the appeal that is presented to the board.
And if they don't do it within 120 days, what?
Then the implementing regulations under the 5 CFR state that if the board does not decide within 120 days, the mixed case complainant may proceed to district court.
Well, that's what I say. That's a time limit on, that's a statute of limitations or decisional limitations on MSPB, isn't it? How does that say anything about that the petitioner must, having brought it, bring it, allow the MSPB to make the decision?
Because the board is directed to decide the case that's before it.
Within a time limit.
Within a time limit.
Right.
And if the board does not decide, then the complainant has the choice to proceed to district court. And that is precisely the analysis which this court followed in Vineratos, which, of course, was not an age discrimination case, but was a case that evaluated the MSPB regulations under 5 CFR. Again, a post-Stevens case, and the Vineratos case cited with approval other circuit decisions that were age discrimination cases, that were also mixed case cases. The Third Circuit in Pertil and the Seventh Circuit in McGinty, again, pre-Stevens cases, which may be implicated by the Stevens decision. But following Stevens, the Second Circuit in Ikonamu, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, had before it a mixed case under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, so it's precisely this type of, and held that the complaint there to the MSPB, and then that withdrew that. At footnote 8, that because, quote, because in the arena before pursuing the Eighth Circuit in McAdams, And page 1142 of the McAdams Circuit. Chosen that prior to exhaust her claim. And continuing, McAdams abandoned her. She had both an ADA elimination claim as well as a case. So the analysis McAdams and the
circuit.
Regulation CFR regime terminated a process when suit is filed. When you begin that to its exhaustion.
But our argument, I just want to make sure I do that. Provision of law that in paragraph and then end of B action in accordance with the board's under 70 and this
of MSA.
Okay, and then it says, what, under paragraph 1, shall be judicial. That's a decision.
It's the 100th provision that allows the complainant to go to the sole decision made. And so it is that two steps. For that 120 period of time. An MSPB decision to review sides with the proceed to district court. Thank you.
No questions.
Okay, I'll give you 1 minute.
Apply to decisions, PB. As we withdrew our claim on the 62nd day, we didn't get to the 120. We did it as a decision. And where there was a hearing, where there was a decision of an MSPB decision. In this case, the situation left to go back to the ADE and say, did Congress to get any agency decision, whether it's the EE Your Honor, I think.
Okay, thank you. The case just argued. Nothing. Thank you, counsel, for. Next case here is Biggs v.
May it please the Court. Whatever questions, but I'll start out by saying.
this court to that board violated Jeffrey Biggs' due process, have his parole suitability rational that are supported by sufficient evidence, and see that we are banned the some evidence, some reliable evidence standard.
Address the liberty interest, which suggests, but in that, and we get to the some evidence, why evidence to support.
Martin is the issue that the pro forma process letting a governor's policy that repeatedly you read, this is at the excerpts of record page conclusion is title, but the BPC Mr. Letty's declaration, the Board of Prison Terms Commissioner Award for no experience at the board and what he observed. The board it's well set out there. If there's any about where he says in no way did they prove that I was an unreasonable risk
to the public safety. Again, at
page 7, is the board is going out of its way to make a decision making to make its decision making method vague.
The board have to prove that he would be a danger to society.
I assert that it does. The statutory language is that you will be that you are suitable unless you pose an unreasonable risk of danger. And the language in there is that you've got an expectation of parole and that it's on the board's burden to find, and it's a low threshold. It's still an agency decision. It's just some reliable evidence to show that you pose an unreasonable risk of danger to the public if you're released. So I don't think the board can come into the hearing.
You're entitled to parole unless the parole board prove certain things?
Unless the parole board finds sufficient evidence, proves that you pose an unreasonable risk of danger to the public. That's what California law requires. That's what the regulations that implement it say. They set out suitability determination characteristics that they're looking at. So they give them some framework that they work through. And I think that the structure is set up that they're entitled to parole unless the board finds evidence of unsuitability because they're a public danger. It's an unreasonable risk of danger to the public.
At what point? The first year after he's sentenced?
No, I mean, they've got a whole separate structure within the regulations and the statute of when one has an initial suitability hearing. I believe when Mr. Biggs was convicted that it was two-thirds of the minimum term of 25 years plus whatever, given whatever custody credits. I think in his case it was about
25 to life, and this was 15 years along the way, wasn't it?
I think it was 15 years along the way. And then you also have to keep in mind that this if one is found suitable, as McQuillian case is a prime example, he was found suitable for parole in 79, I think, from a early 70s conviction. So it was an even shorter time frame between when the conviction, when he got the CDC, and when he was found suitable. But his release date was decades later. So the separate question of applying the matrix and assessing when he should be released is a separate problem. So the concern that you might be go to prison for a life term, be found suitable a year later, and released 3 weeks later is nowhere in the cards in this case. It's not something you're going to have to be concerned with. The problem.
What he's asking for is a fixed date.
He's asking for, at this point, he's not even asking for the fixed date in reality. I mean, the limitation of the petition is that he's asking for a fair hearing by a fair board. The fair hearing portion was discussed by the district court.
Let me be sure now, because we've moved from, you know, originally the argument was an attack on some evidence. Now I ask you, okay, why isn't there some evidence? You're saying, well, The thing you'd like to really address is why you didn't, why the district court didn't go into this flap about Governor Davis's alleged per se policy in the Rosencrantz case and so on and so forth. So what is it that you wanted to, you say he didn't get a fair hearing, but you haven't addressed why there isn't some evidence. So you're just saying we should, the district court should have determined that this was a bogus hearing, no matter if they said the right kinds of things to satisfy some evidence. We should, the court should look behind it and say, well, this is, they're just doing lip service.
If the district court had found that it was a pro forma hearing that was a lip service, then his due process rights would have been violated.
So the answer is yes. So you're saying if there was no evidence that they were just doing lip service, that what they did say would meet the some evidence test?
I'm not conceding that there is some evidence. And the problem that I have intellectually analyzing it is between there are two separate problems with going straight to the some evidence standard and ignoring everything else that we raised in the brief. One is that the district court didn't have the transcript of the parole hearing. So I think you really have to look at the parole hearing transcript, not just the decisional portion that they had, to assess the some evidence. And that we put in the brief, and I don't really have anything to add to it. I think that a number of the standards, as the district court found, and even others that it found some evidence for, don't really have some evidence when you look at what was actually said during the hearing. For example, there were some questions about his sincerity or I just blanked it out. Those I don't have anything. I'm not really addressing because I don't have anything to add to what I put in the briefs. The other aspect that I think is problematic is that I don't think the district court can make an accurate sum evidence assessment without calculating into it what evidence there is that the board was biased when it was discussing the evidence.
So your suggestion is that based on these statements of Mr. Biggs pro se on page 20 of his petition, that the district court should have engaged in an examination of Governor Davis's parole policy, basically. Isn't that what that boils down to?
It has to address that issue and what effect that might have had on the board. I'm not relying solely on page 20, but it again shows up in his answer. It again shows up in his objection. So I think the court had notice of it and it just failed to address that issue. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for
you may.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Deputy Attorney General Jessica Blanion, appearing for appellees. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit right to the question of whether or not there was some evidence, because counsel is just addressing it. And I think it's important for the Court to look at the Penal Code, Section 3041B, where it specifically states that the gravity of the conviction offense, the timing or gravity of the conviction offense, should be considered to determine whether or not public safety requires a more lengthy period of incarceration. I think the board did consider that and found that because of the conviction offense, a more lengthy term of incarceration was warranted. I believe the district court did the same thing, and implicit in that finding, there's a showing that there is some evidence to deny parole, which also is a showing that the decision was not based on bias. Because there's some evidence to support the decision, it's clear that the decision was not made due to a bias of the board.
Just help me understand how this parole process works when they have the first, he's had a second hearing, I guess, as well in the interval, but we're looking at the first hearing, I gather.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
So when he comes up, what is it that the statute commands, that there be a parole date unless the board finds?
The specific language is the panel or board shall set a release date unless it determines that the gravity of the current convicted offense or offenses.
No, I understand. Okay, so that's, I'm just trying to get, so what the prisoner coming into a parole hearing is looking for is a release date, and it may be a number of years in the future, but it's a target date against which he's now been judged to merit likely parole. Can always be revoked for cause, I gather.
Correct.
As it was in McQuillian, actually.
Correct. And it's actually two separate decisions, one, whether or not the inmate's suitable for parole, where there's a number of factors that are considered that are laid out in the California Code of Regulations and in the Penal Code. And then the second decision, if they are found suitable, what is the appropriate term?
All right. So in this case, it was suitability?
Correct.
And because of the nature of the offense, that decided he wasn't suitable enough to set a release date?
There were a number of decisions. The nature of the offense was the primary reason. There were also Mr. Biggs's failure to profit from previous terms of probation and parole. He continued his criminality. There was also issues of whether or not further therapy was required.
But that all, that probation, that was pre-incarceration for this offense, right?
Pre-incarceration for this offense.
So after 15 years in, as a essentially a model prisoner, that's what they were saying, that they were going back to the nature of the offense and what he did during that period when he was 17 and 18?
That was the primary reason, correct. And I mean,
has the California Supreme Court addressed Governor Davis's policy? Didn't the Rosenkranz case?
It did. The Rosenkranz case was directly on point, and the evidence that Mr. Biggs submitted with his petition was considered by the court in addition to other evidence. And the Supreme Court found that there was not a blanket parole policy, that the board and the governor did examine each case and consider all the factors. They gave them each individual consideration, which is what was required under the California regulations.
Didn't they also find that there was liberty interest?
They actually did not address the federal due process standard. They did, though, hold that there was a right to have some procedures and that some evidence was required. That's correct.
All right. So is the state still arguing in this case that we should say there isn't a liberty interest?
Under federal law, we would argue that Sandin should apply and that given Sandin, you should look for an atypical and significant hardship, and that a life prisoner who goes to a hearing and doesn't receive a date stays in the same position he was as before having the date. And understanding that would not require a due process right.
You don't think McQuillian forecloses that?
McQuillian, I think, is factually different because Mr. McQuillian had a parole date that was rescinded.
What's the substantive difference between the two?
Well,
it said, didn't it read, Sandin is being limited to disciplinary cases?
It did,
yeah.
Your Honor, it did. And under Greenholz, I don't think there is a question that a due process right applies.
Okay.
So should the court apply Greenholz, I think that would resolve the issue in line with McQuillian.
All right.
Just turning to the conviction offense and the board's some evidence finding, the board found that in the commitment offense, there was a callous disregard for human suffering and also that the commitment offense was carried out in a dispassionate and calculated manner. Here, Mr. Biggs plotted the murder with his co-conspirators. He agreed to transport the murderer to the scene of the crime, which he did. He actually switched out his car so he wouldn't be recognized. He then watched as the victim was bludgeoned and stabbed to death, and then he met his crime partners after the crime where there was an exchange of money. The whole purpose of the murder was to prevent the murder victim from testifying in a crime. And the board properly considered all these factors and weighed them and decided that they presented the sum evidence, the primary reason, to deny Mr. Biggs parole. Unless you have any other questions.
Judge Gibson?
I have no questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I just have a few responses. I think you've addressed properly that, and she has conceded that Sandin doesn't apply given McQuillian's holding. As far as the last comment she made about the facts, I would only correct that there is no evidence, and the board did not find that Mr. Biggs actually watched the murder. He did aid. He didn't stop it. He did actually bring the person who committed the murder back to more carefully dispose of the body. So he fully admitted to those participations, but he didn't watch.
I'm not hearing your mumbling.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify a factual assertion she just made about Mr. Biggs having watched the victim being bludgeoned. That did not happen. Mr. Biggs was there, and he admitted, and the board found that he participated as far as transporting the killer, and even worse in my mind, took the killer back so that the killer could redispose of the body once they found out he'd just been dumped. But he didn't watch the murder, if that makes any difference. The Attorney General's argument regarding...
it's clear that he participated in the whole thing.
Right. There's no dispute about it. It's just... if that particular factual assertion makes a difference, it's not right.
Do you think it does?
No, but I don't want to leave it dangling there. My only other main significant point is, I believe I wrote this down, that she's arguing that bias isn't you can't prove bias by the board if there exists some evidence to support the decision. That just logically doesn't make any sense. You can have a biased decision maker that would undermine someone's due process rights and still have some pieces of evidence that would support it. That doesn't mean the process.
I mean, biased judges can always salt the record.
Right. I mean, I could be an ALJ and somewhere saying I hate black people and, you know, and piecemeal decisions so that I can do that. And that's clearly unconstitutional. His allegation is that the panel was biased.
Whole panel?
Yes.
Okay.
And what is the evidence of that?
The evidence he presented in his petition was the Leddy Declaration, asserting what Mr. Leddy's, from his experience at the board as a chairman and as a board member.
The same people?
The Leddy Declaration basically says that the governor's policy has had a systemic effect in causing the commissioners not to follow the statutory requirements. So it's a systemic bias that the system has collapsed.
Well, it's a bias of anyone that serves on the parole board because the governor has a policy?
Yes, that the governor's policy has affected in bias their decision making.
This is the governor who announced that the legislature's duty was to enact his vision, I think, when he first took office.
The same one. In 99, I believe the governor was, I forgot to write my chronology, I think Pete Wilson was still governor, but the policy has continued. I acknowledge, because you're smiling at me a little bit, that this is a difficult thing for him to prove, but that's not my point at this point. I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
No, I think we understand what the issue is. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. The case just argued will be submitted. Next case is Lopez Urenda versus Ashcroft.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
Mark Vanderhoof.
Why don't you let the folks clear out behind you? It's a little cramped here. Okay. Thank you for...
Good morning. Mark Vanderhoof, along with Stephanie Goldsboro from our office on behalf...
Please talk into the mic.
Sorry. On behalf of Mr. Lopez Urenda, who is in court here today, the issue in this case is whether the elimination of suspension of deportation contained in the 96 IRA-IRA enactment can be applied retroactively to petitioner, given the unique facts of his particular case. Petitioner applied for asylum on September the 6th, 1996, before IRA and the elimination of suspension and deportation were passed by Congress.
And you're mindful, now you're trying to steer us around Vasquez-Zavala.
Correct, Your Honor. It's very distinguishable, and I'll explain
why.
When petitioner applied for asylum, he relinquished his right to have the government carry its burden of proving his deportability. And he did so in exchange for the right to apply for asylum and, if asylum were denied, to have a full deportation hearing subsequently where he would be able to apply for suspension of deportation. But 3 weeks after he did that, Congress enacted IRA, eliminating deportation proceeding, eliminating suspension of deportation, and stripping him of his ability to do so. Instead, when his asylum application was denied 1 year later, he was placed in removal proceedings based on the concessions that he made in his asylum application and was told he was no longer eligible for suspension of deportation. Now, we believe this is distinguishable both from Vasquez-Zavala and this Court's prior decision in Jimenez-Angeles. I'd like to explain why. Unlike Petitioner here, who filed his asylum application before Congress enacted IRA, Vasquez-Zavala filed his application in March 1997. IRA had already been enacted. The statute was clear. It wasn't going to go into effect for another 3 weeks, but it was clear that he was not going to be able to qualify for a suspension of deportation when Vasquez-Zavala filed that application. He had no expectations. Vasquez-Zavala had no expectations whatsoever of being able to apply for a suspension of deportation. Because of that, he didn't make the claims we make here. He didn't make the claims that he gave up important procedural and constitutional rights when he filed for suspension, nor did he make the claim that he had a settled expectation that he would be able to file for a suspension of deportation. And thus, the Court didn't address that issue whatsoever. Similarly, in Jimenez-Angeles, the Court said that all she did was give up her ability to live in the United States undetected when she reported to the INS and requested the issuance of an order to show cause. But again, she did that in March 1997, 5 months after, or 6 months after IRA was enacted, fully aware that she would not be eligible to apply for suspension of deportation if INS put her in proceedings after April 1st, 1997. There was no obligation to do it. There wasn't the quid pro quo in either of those cases.
I want to make sure I understand your argument, because Vasquez-Zavala relies and adopts Uspongo,
correct,
which is a Third Circuit case, which does talk about quid pro quo and says there wasn't any. So and how do you – is that where you're headed? You're
going to do next.
Thank
exactly.
You. Okay, good.
What the Third Circuit says in Uspongo is Uspongo gave up no rights when the filing the petition for asylum and did not receive any benefits from having – and the government didn't receive any benefits from having in file for asylum. That in Uspongo, although the application was submitted prior to the enactment, the petitioner in that case simply did not make the argument to the court, didn't present to the Third Circuit at all the statute, the regulations, and the warning on the asylum application. And so the court didn't address this issue at all, and so that is not binding precedent on this court. And it's very important. The Third Circuit made a big point of saying that no rights were given up.
You're skipping a step before you jump ahead there. You say, now the Third Circuit, it wasn't argued in the Third Circuit. So
and
we come back to Vasquez, which says the Third Circuit noted the uniqueness of St. Cyr's plea bargain quid pro quo situation and rejected any similar expectations, thereby adopting the quid pro quo rationale of Uspongo. And you're saying we should look beyond that because it wasn't argued in the Third Circuit.
In either case, correct. Factually, it couldn't have been argued.
This is dictum.
It couldn't have been argued in Vasquez-Zavala because it wasn't factually the same. Vasquez-Zavala applied only 3 weeks before. We didn't raise. This is a very, very important right that the alien gives up, and that's why they specifically said in enacting in promulgating the regulations in December 1994, they said, and this is our opening brief at page 25, the asylum application is often the only source of information available to the service to initiate proceedings before the immigration judge. And on page 27, similarly in that preamble to the regulation, the department believes that the alien's written admission of alienage and of having no lawful status in the United States is sufficient to satisfy the standard of evidence for establishing deportability. Consequently, the new asylum application will contain a warning, clear warning, that the application may be used to establish deportability. This part of the final rule will not be applied retroactively and will affect only those persons who make an application on the new form. And they did that because they said this is such an important right the person is giving up when they apply for asylum. We are now changing the regulations. Before, they could not use that information under HCFR 242.17. They couldn't use that information. In December 1994, they changed the regulation. They said, from here on in, anyone who applies for asylum is going to give up their very important right to have the government meet its burden of proof in proving deportability. And because it's so important, we're going to put a warning on there telling them that. And that warning is contained in the excerpt of record at 7, which is asylum application that we submitted. Did Mr. Lopez Urenda lose something very important in this bargain when he wasn't allowed ultimately to file for a suspension? Absolutely. The immigration judge, in ruling that she felt she was without power to allow him to file for suspension, said, had this respondent been eligible for relief in removal proceedings, either through suspension or deportation or cancellation of removal, he would have been a good candidate for that relief and appears to be a person who would contribute to this country in a meaningful and positive way. So it is with some distress and a great deal of empathy for the respondent that the court feels it must go forward at this point and grant the only relief available, voluntary departure. He has 2 U.S. citizen children. He's been here for years. He gave up important rights when he filed for his asylum application, thinking if denied, he could file for suspension of deportation, would have been granted based on what the immigration judge says, and that was stripped of him 3 weeks later. We think under Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf and in St. Cyr, it falls right within that and is distinguishable from Vasquez, Zavala, Jimenez, and Uspongo, and I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Anne Tumeyer. I represent the Attorney General. Contrary to petitioner's claims, Vasquez Zavala, as well as Jimenez Angeles, do control this case because IRA-IRA governs his proceedings, and he has no settled expectation. The distinctions that he raises are two, and both are unavailing. The first distinction is that he was not aware of the existence of IRA-IRA at the time that he submitted his asylum application, whereas Vasquez was aware of it and submitted his application just prior to the effective date, and there's a distinction there. Well, that's an insignificant distinction when this Court said in Vasquez that the basis for its decision in dismissing the petition was because it was the fact that he had no settled expectation as to whether his application would be denied, and even if it were denied, he had no expectation as to when the proceedings would commence. The emphasis is on the timing of the proceedings. Petitioner suggests that Vasquez actually had an expectation as to the timing of the proceedings, and that is completely erroneous. Therefore, the distinction is insignificant. Now, the second distinction that he makes is that he did have a settled expectation that he had initiated some sort of formal exchange which was comparable to that of St. Cyr, and that is flawed. There was no formal exchange like that of the plea bargain in St. Cyr, and this Court has already stated so in Jimenez and Vasquez, and the Third Circuit said so in Uspango. There was no loss of a right, and there was no gain by either side. Here, as far as petitioner is concerned, he did not give up any protected right. He does not have a right to to make the government sustain its burden of proof. The burden of proof is required. In fact, in this case, the government still had to sustain its burden of proving his alienage. And I would point out that the basis for finding him deportable was not any information obtained from his asylum application. Rather, it was his own admissions during the removal proceedings. At that time, he cannot argue that he was not aware, he was not subject to removal proceedings and the law as it existed. He knew and he conceded that he was subject to removal. So there was no right that he gave up. He also did not, even if he gave up some sort of right, he did not do so to gain a benefit. There was no benefit from him, for him to gain. He was placed in proceedings, and he had submitted his asylum application in 1996. He entered the U.S. in March 1st, 1990. That means that he would have had to have some sort of expectation that the INS would commence proceedings no earlier than March 1st, 1997. That means that he had some sort of expectation as to when the proceedings would have commenced. This Court has already stated that the alien has no such expectation. So, therefore, he could not have gained anything. In addition to that, he acknowledges in his letter brief at page 6, and St. Cyr has stated, he would have had to have been eligible for the form of relief he's seeking at the time that he submitted his asylum application. He wasn't. And the government also did not lose anything, nor did it gain much of anything that would have been contemplated by St. Cyr. The government basically did not induce him to do anything. By voluntarily submitting himself and his application for asylum, the government did not force him to do anything, and they didn't gain it because they still had to establish his alienage. And as stated earlier, he gave up that evidence on his own accord. He voluntarily did so, and the government, if anything, gained a limited benefit in limiting some of its resources or prosecutorial resources. But as this Court stated in Vasquez, that is not the kind of gain that the government received that would have been contemplated by St. Cyr. As a result, there really is no distinction between Jimenez and Vasquez, and this Court is required to dismiss this case.
Okay. Judge Gibson, did you have any questions?
No questions.
Thank you.
A couple responses, Jens. I would refer the Court, to our letter brief on Vasquez-Zavala. I think it's clearly distinguishable, and I would urge the Court to look at that again. I think this is clearly distinguishable from Vasquez-Zavala because of the fact that, when he applied, he did not know that the law was going to be changing, obviously, and the government said, we're going to warn you about this because you are giving up very important rights. Because of that, this is really, we believe, is controlled by St. Cyr. It was pretty much the same situation there. In St. Cyr, the individual in pleading guilty allowed the government not to have to sustain its burden of proof in that case. And similarly here, there is a concession of deportability, essentially, in the information provided, and that's set forth in the regulations and in the warning on the application. There was definitely an exchange here, and he did give up something very important. I would like to clarify, though, that this is not a situation contrary to what the government attorney argues.
You might clarify for me what it was that he gave up.
The government has the burden of proving elements of deportability and including alienage. And what the...
Was the alienage aspect of it that was given up?
Correct, Your Honor. He...
Or anything else, but...
Well, that's the alienage? That's the essential... the whole fact that he was from another country, was unlawfully in the United States. And the warning and the regulation says that that's an important thing that the government has to prove, and the immigrant in filing for asylum.
Would there be really any problem of proving alienage?
There often is, Your Honor. We cited the Ramon Sepulveda case of this circuit to the court where alienage was the only issue in that case. The government couldn't prove.
This case.
Pardon?
About this case.
Well, correct.
Would there be a problem in this case?
Well, yes, Your Honor, because there would have been a problem. He came forward and gave the information to the...
I know that, but if he hadn't done that, then what?
If the INS had somehow come across him in some other way, you mean?
Well, that's a different thing as to whether he's discovered or not. But That isn't what you're arguing, is that he came forward and was therefore discovered. You're arguing that he gave up the problem that the government might have in proving alien age?
Correct, Your Honor.
Certainly did give up as far as being discovered, but I don't think that's a basis on which you're arguing or could argue.
Well, the warning on the asylum application is very specific about that. And in the preamble to the December 1994 regulations, which we cite in our brief, the Department of Justice was very specific that the alien was giving up an important right in having the government in not having to prove alienage and deportability.
How's this different from Jimenez?
It's different in Jimenez because the individual did not file for asylum, wasn't forced to give up her right in.
Came forward, and the opinion says, well, that doesn't rise to the level of St. Cyr.
Correct, but that's very different because it wasn't a quid pro quo. Here, the individual is allowed to file for asylum by regulation, is compelled to give up her right to have the government prove deportability. She knows, or he knows, that if denied asylum, he would be placed in deportation proceedings and would be giving up his right to have the government prove meet its burden of proof, which is a very, very important right in a deportation proceeding. The Supreme Court has said it would.
The irony of it is that in all probability, that if he had not filed for asylum, that he wouldn't have been discovered by the time the 10 years was
correct.
Up, which appears to be the case.
That's,
but I'm not sure that's something we can take into account as to the discovery aspect.
Well, you can, and I know where the Court's going with this. Did Jimenez-Angeles cover that issue? And we think not. And the reason is Jimenez-Angeles didn't involve the issue of coming forward and applying for asylum, and that's a very important difference. Jimenez-Angeles just said, I knock on the door of INS. I said, here I am. Please put me in proceedings in the next 3 weeks so I can qualify before the law changes. And the INS, you know, basically didn't do that. And the Supreme Court and ADC has said, there's no ability to force the INS to do it on the timing. We're not raising a timing issue here. We're not raising that the government had an obligation to put him in proceedings before April 1st, 1997 at all. We're saying when he applied for asylum, he had the expectation that he'd be eligible for suspension of deportation. He gave up his right to have the government prove deportability by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence, as it has to and would be, and then that was stripped away from 3 weeks later. So we do think this falls within St. Cyr and is not bound by Vasquez-Zavala.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank the you. Case just argued will be submitted. Okay. Judge Gibson, are you good to go for two more cases?
I think I can make it.
Okay. We'll just.
I may ask a question in a little while.
All right. All right, the next case on calendar is Mendez-Gutierrez versus Ashcroft.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jonathan Kaufman. I represent the petitioner. This is an immigration case. It's a petition review of a deportation order entered against the petitioner by the BIA, and the petition requires the court to determine if the BIA deprived the petitioner of a full and fair hearing on his application for asylum in the United States.
This is the fellow whose party now has the presidency of Mexico, correct?
Excuse me?
Is this the fellow whose party has the presidency of Mexico? Am I getting the right case?
That's the factual assertion. That
yes, that's what I thought.
Brief.
Yes.
But that's not really the issue that the BIA addressed or the immigration judge addressed. The petitioner applied for asylum affirmatively to the INS, and his application was referred to an immigration judge for consideration in a removal proceeding. When he appeared at his master calendar hearing, he withdrew his asylum application based on the erroneous belief that he was eligible for other forms of relief from removal. When he got to his individual calendar hearing, it was determined that, in fact, he was not eligible for any other form of relief, and he sought to.
It's the basis that they thought that he had entered in 1986. whereas he really had entered in 1989?
That's correct. And then because of the stop time rule, he was ineligible for
cancellation. Who made that mistake? Was that you?
No. I didn't represent him at the removal hearing.
That's a good thing.
The attorney who represented him has been disbarred.
Yeah, that's...
The immigration judge would not permit petitioner to reinstate his application for asylum and didn't state any reason at all for not permitting him to go ahead and apply for asylum in light of the fact that he wasn't eligible for any other relief from removal at that point. That decision was appealed to the BIA, and the BIA found that, in fact, the judge or the BIA was critical of the immigration judge for having failed to articulate any reason. The BIA found that the petitioner's desire to reinstate his asylum application, given the circumstances, was reasonable. And the BIA also refused to let him have an asylum hearing, but for an entirely different reason. The BIA said that the written application failed to state a prima facie case, and petitioner failed to show that he was prejudiced by not having a hearing on his asylum application.
You would like this to be treated, what, as a motion to reopen?
No, I think that it's wrong to place this petitioner into the position of someone who's asking to reopen a case.
Well, if it's not analogous to a motion to reopen, what the government argues, I think, that we don't have jurisdiction then, because what are we supposed to be reviewing? What's the standard of discretion?
The standard of discretion is the standard stated by the BIA. Number one, was it appropriate for the BIA to say that where an alien is making a reasonable request to reinstate an asylum application that was erroneously withdrawn, that he has to meet the standards of a motion to reopen, that he has to show prima facie eligibility, whether or not that is an abuse of discretion by the BIA in saying that those standards must be met. Where an alien has not been ordered deported, an alien isn't seeking to reopen a case that has already been concluded, he's appearing at an individual calendar hearing that's been scheduled. Time has been blocked off to consider applications he wants to make for relief from removal. Nothing could be more reasonable than that. And so to say that he has to actually present a prima facie case, I think, is an arbitrary standard that's being applied to an alien in that situation. But even if the court wants to say that the BIA was not abusive in making that standard, then the way that it applied the law to the facts of this case was wrong, and the court would view the BIA's finding that prima facie eligibility was not established de novo, because that's a legal finding. And the application did, in fact, state in a very minimal way, but did state facts from which it could be proven that he had a well-founded fear of persecution, which the BIA didn't even analyze. All the BIA analyzed was whether or not the application stated facts to prove past persecution. The court
just
also...
I just want to make sure now I understand the argument. You're saying that this is a unique motion for reinstatement, and that it's looking at the reinstatement motion, we can determine, we have jurisdiction to determine whether it was arbitrary and capricious on the part of the board to have required or imposed the prima facie showing standard that's used in removal hearings.
I do, Your Honor. I don't think that the government's position that the APA precludes judicial review of this BIA decision is very meritorious. It is correct that there is no statute that dictates the standards that an alien needs to be in order to reinstate an application that he erroneously withdrew based on a reasonable assumption that he wasn't eligible. I mean, you have a lot of different factors. Because the absence of a statute dictating a standard is irrelevant, because the BIA itself, in its decision, set up the standard that it was going to follow. It set up legal criteria. An alien needed to prove prima facie eligibility. An alien needed to prove that he was prejudiced as a result of the IJ's possible error.
But then what are we reviewing it for? Are we, that's what I'm trying.
For abuse of discretion.
Of what they decided in terms of whether he made the prima facie showing or whether they erred in imposing the prima facie requirement in the first place.
I would say that it's a two-step
process. So how did they set up the standard? That's what I'm trying to understand.
They set up the standard because the Attorney General said that the BIA, by regulation, exercises the Attorney General's discretion to do what is necessary and appropriate for the disposition of the case.
I know. I understand if you're asking us to review whether they applied the prima facie rule appropriately, okay? But I'm having trouble understanding, and I apologize for being slow, but what is the standard by which we judge whether they adopted that standard appropriately or not? What do we look to?
You would look to the regulation, which requires that they exercise discretion, and you would then apply an abuse of discretion standard to their to their decision.
Well, okay. Is there a showing required of what a prima facie showing of why he would be eligible for asylum?
That's what the BIA did. The BIA said that he had to actually show that. That the application had a certain level of merit.
Yeah.
If he hadn't withdrawn the application.
Are you contending that's not the case, that was error?
I think that was error also, because by saying that at the point where the hearing was ongoing, that really the only issue, as far as BIA should have been concerned, was whether there was good reason for him to have withdrawn the application. Was there a reason to let him reinstate the application? Not what is the merit of the application, but...
Well, I think we're both having a problem of deciding what it is that the alien has to show in order to get it reinstated.
That that he had filed a timely application.
All right.
And that it was withdrawn for... that there's a good cause for permitting him to reinstate it.
That's it, the good cause for reinstatement.
Yes.
And that, and as a part of that good cause, isn't there a showing necessary that he has at least a prima facie case for proving asylum?
Our first argument, Your Honor, would be that the BIA erred in saying that had to be met, that there had to be a prima facie showing of eligibility.
Otherwise, he isn't prejudiced by having withdrawn it, is he? If he doesn't have a case.
That's correct. But that's a second issue that arises here. The first issue is whether or not he has to show prima facie. But yes, we would concede that if, in fact, he did not have...
Assuming that he did have to show it, what has he shown?
Well, he did show it, in fact, a prima facie case.
Well, that's what I would like to hear. What is it?
Well, his prima facie case was that he said he was a member of a political party. He says that the government's federal police would harass him, would question him, would detain him, would take him to a desolate place, and would threaten him, all in an effort to make him terminate his political affiliation. Mm-hmm. So that's a prima facie case for asylum.
Well, and I guess that the reliance on the IJ was that, look, that's all being alleged, but there's no past persecution that would indicate that there's going to be anything in the future.
Well, the IJ didn't articulate any reason for having permitted permitting the petitioner to reinstate his application. That's what the BIA said, was that there was no past persecution. But the BIA didn't analyze in any manner the application under a standard of a well-founded fear. They just said there's no past persecution.
Well, but isn't that the reason why they were looking to past persecution? I mean, past persecution can be a basis alone. It has to be a severe persecution and so forth, but the point of past persecution usually is to show that it's going to continue on in the future, and that's a reason for a well-founded fear of persecution in the future. And they're saying there was none of that.
No, but a well-founded fear can be established even if there is no past persecution. Past persecution makes a presumption.
That's right. It helps. And I think that's what
help.
They were, yeah.
And I think that there's it could be argued that this application doesn't state sufficient facts to prove past persecution. But it could still...
It could be argued, was there anything you said about past persecution?
Well, there was threats and harassment.
Hmm. Okay.
My time's up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello again, Your Honors. Antu Mai for the government. The key in this case is that petitioner is attempting to shift responsibility for his own error. The case represents his efforts to resurrect an asylum application which he voluntarily withdrew. There is
by
no
mistake.
I'm sorry?
By mistake.
Yes, Your Honor, but it was something that in withdrawing any application, it is incumbent on the petitioner to know what he's doing, that to voluntarily do so based on the circumstances.
All right. We have somebody who by mistake withdrew the application. What do you contend has to be shown in order to reinstate it?
Your Honor, at a minimum, well, when you withdraw your application, you, in effect, terminate the application just as a proceeding in which you actually presented evidence and the immigration judge denied the application. It's effectively the same type of result, and as a result, in doing so, in order to...
What authority do you have for that proposition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could...
What authority do you have for that proposition?
Your Honor, it's...
That the withdrawal is the same as trying the case and losing it.
Your Honor, I can't provide the court with any authority off the top of my head. It's more of a reasoned conclusion because the end result is the same, that by withdrawing the application, there is no longer an application that exists. There's nothing that there's no benefit that is gained from the withdrawal of the application, just as there is no benefit gained when the application is denied. In any event, there is no standard for measuring a request or the denial of a request to reinstate, and as a result, the court doesn't have jurisdiction under 5 U.S.C. 701. As the court has indicated and as petitioners have failed to articulate, there really is no basis on which the court can measure whether or not it's appropriate for the agency to deny the request for reinstatement.
I'm sorry, you said the court has indicated?
Well, it was based on some of the questions, at least the line of questions.
But you shouldn't read those.
I apologize, Your Honor. I will rely solely on...
Don't count on this court as...
Then I rely solely on the fact that
your position.
That petitioner had was unable to respond to the court's questions sufficiently to
That's
establish.
Your judgment, but that's not necessarily the judgment of the court.
Yes, Your Honor. In any event, regardless of whether the court believes that there is an agency action here that is committed solely to the discretion of the agency such that the court has no jurisdiction.
You're saying that even though you're supposed to exercise discretion, we can't review it for an abuse of discretion?
Not when there is no standard. This court has stated...
You can't give us any authority as to why you treat this motion the same as a motion for reopening. That's just a reasoned conclusion on your part, and
yes,
we should defer to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And there is no standard for it, and as this court has stated in the series of cases that were indicated in the government's brief, when there is no law by which we can base the court's jurisdiction, the court has no review under 5 U.S.C. 701.
All right. Assuming we don't accept that arguendo,
yes,
I have a question about, and assuming that the board could have within its discretion applied the prima facie case requirement that it does in removal proceedings. The circuit recently got its hand slapped for taking upon itself to resolve the question of whether or not changed circumstances mooted the issue of persecution. Speaking of the INS versus Ventura, we were told that when the Board of Immigration Appeals didn't resolve that question itself, that we should not take it upon ourselves to do so, even if it appeared, in this case, for example, that the party to which the claimant, the petitioner, is a member, is now the governing party of Mexico. Should we remand this to the BIA then, or should we decide that issue ourselves?
Your Honor, the circumstances are different, and for one, the standard of review in the case of Ventura was different because it was a matter of whether or not there was substantial evidence to support the board's determinations. Here we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard, if any standard at all is to be applied, and in looking to determine whether or not petitioner has presented any kind of evidence, any valid claim, the court may take a look at, and must take a look at the entire record and can consider it de novo as far as whether or not there's a prima facie showing here. Because in order to assess whether there was a due process violation, the court can look at the record de novo. And because petitioner, in effect, has raised a due process violation claim, the court must consider the entire record, including evidence that may be judicially noticeable. And the current circumstances do reflect upon the validity of petitioner's asylum claim. Even if the court were to consider the application, the court would have to determine whether he can establish his burden of proving by specific evidence that he had either been persecuted in the past or had a well-founded fear of future persecution. As the board had indicated, there was no showing of past persecution based on harassment and empty threats. And this court has already stated in various cases, Lim and a slew of others, that empty threats and harassment are not sufficient for a claim of past persecution. As far as a well-founded fear of persecution, he cannot establish that given that the current party that is in control is the party which he affiliated himself. And he, at a minimum, in making a claim of a due process violation, has to show that there is some sort of prejudice because he could make a prima facie case.
Well, how should this court, I mean, we can take judicial notice generally, but is this court really in a position, if we're down to reasonable fear of future prosecution, predict the status of what's going on in Mexico? Vicente Fox is not necessarily as popular now. What if PRI comes back into power? I mean, are those judgments we should be making?
Your Honor, it's a consideration that the court can and should make in a claim of a due process violation. Besides the fact that petitioner has not been denied an opportunity to be heard by the agency, it's his own error that really precluded him from having a hearing. The fact of the matter is he still has to show prejudice, and he cannot establish prejudice if the court takes a look at and applies the de novo standard, which it can do so in a due process challenge, to look at the record and then find that, well, has he established a prima facie case? And that means that the court can consider judicially noticeable facts, especially where his claim is based on his affiliation with a party that is currently in power.
But shouldn't we wait until the BIA addresses the question of well-founded fear of future persecution? All the BIA addressed was past persecution.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why should we do it when they haven't? Shouldn't we remand it for them to do it?
The court may do so to be on the safe side and remand it back to the board. However, because this is a due process challenge and the basis for the denial of the request for reinstatement is that he couldn't establish a due process violation, and again, in applying a de novo standard of review, the court may consider, it's a different standard of review than that of INS v. Ventura. In that case, deference had to be accorded to the board's decision. And if the board did not make a determination on an issue, then out of deference to the board's expertise, the court had to remand it.
He has, in fact, made a case for a well-founded fear of persecution just by making a de novo review, and we reverse the BIA and say, yeah, he's entitled to stay.
Your Honor, no, that would be far-reaching because the board didn't and the agency never made a decision on an asylum application because he had withdrawn the asylum application. This court may, if it chooses to do so, and finds that he did.
Say under due process, we can do all this de novo reviewing, and I'm just wondering if that carries that far.
No, Your Honor. The de novo review is limited to determining whether he has established a prima facie case of eligibility.
So what you're saying is we could, applying de novo review, conclude that there is some reasonable basis to consider a fear of future prosecution, and therefore he has made his prima facie case. He satisfied the prima facie case. So now he's entitled to have the matter reopened, to reinstate.
If the court,
we could do that.
If I understand correctly, if I can restate my understanding of it, Your Honor, if the court applies a de novo review and looks at the entire record and finds that there is a reasonable possibility that he has an asylum claim, then the court could find that the board should actually allow him to reinstate his asylum application.
Thank you.
And in this case, he has no case.
No, I understand you take that point. I just don't want to.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Get the Solicitor General going after us again.
Yes, Your
Honor. Wait, you have a minute.
I think that the issue or the fact that the petitioner voluntarily withdrew his asylum application is a red herring because the BIA said that he acted reasonably in seeking to reinstate it. So it really doesn't matter. He voluntarily withdrew it, but the BIA said that he acted reasonably ultimately in wanting to renew it. And as far as the court's ability to take judicial notice of changed country conditions, the court could take judicial notice that Vicente Fox is now the president of Mexico, but that doesn't really end the inquiry. And more importantly, at no point in the pleadings and at no point until today did the government ask the court to take judicial notice. So the fact that the court does have the authority to take judicial notice, it must be requested to do that. If it, in its brief, it had asked for judicial notice, then possibly it could be appropriately done. But to come here today and to say that the court does have that authority is, well, it's correct, but it hasn't, the government hasn't properly invoked that authority. So I don't know that the court can, in fact, take judicial notice under these circumstances.
All right. Thank you. Judge Gibson, any questions?
No questions.
Thank you. Case just argued will be submitted. Thank you both. The next case on calendar, Sosa versus Ashcroft, has been submitted on the briefs, as has the next case on calendar, Lopez Rodriguez versus Ashcroft, also submitted on the briefs, and the final case on calendar is Howard versus Barnhart. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Caldwell. I'm here this morning representing Sarah Wolf in this child's disability case. As a preliminary matter, if I may, I'd like to request permission to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may reserve. Just watch your time.
Thank you, Judge. There's two ways this Court can handle this case. The first one I'll only address briefly because I think it's pretty straightforward. That's remand for award of benefits. The case I would cite in support of that is the Schneider case, where this Court said that lay testimony can be credited. And in Schneider, the Court indeed used lay testimony to find that the claimant's condition equaled the presumptive disability criteria in the listing of impairments. This case is a little bit easier than Schneider in two respects. One, in Schneider, the ALJ found that the lay testimony was not credible, or at least didn't consider it. Here, the ALJ specifically found that the aunt's testimony, Sherry Howard's testimony, was credible. He just didn't factor it into his conclusions. Two, the 1996 amendments don't require a citation to a specific listing when finding equivalence. It's sufficient to find that equivalence is in general to the listing of impairments. That's the easy part. The hard part is if this case, this Court decides to remand this case for further proceedings, in that case, I believe we are faced with a question of first impression, and that is interpretation of the statute that requires the Commissioner to make reasonable efforts that a pediatrician or other appropriate specialist evaluate the individual's case. Here, the ALJ was specifically asked to call a medical expert to testify at the hearing. He specifically declined to do so, so we know that the ALJ made no effort to call a medical expert to evaluate the case of the individual. Instead, the ALJ based his decision, and I'm quoting directly, "my review of the medical evidence." The ALJ made a review of the medical evidence in his decision, then reached a conclusion that the claimant did not equal the listings, but he never married those two things together. Why does a review of the medical evidence fail to show that the claimant equaled the criteria of the listings? That's exactly the practice that this Court discouraged in the Regenreiter case, where it said simply listing objective factors, even if done seriatim, is not enough to fulfill the ALJ's obligations. The district court, although I realize the district court's decision isn't what's being reviewed here, but the district court made what I consider to be a mistake. The district court said, well, the child's had a lot of evaluations. A lot of people have seen this child. And that pretty much was what the ALJ said, too. My response to that is the plain language of the statute doesn't say the commissioner shall make a reasonable effort to have the child examined, because there are already provisions for that in terms of consultative examinations. The commissioner said the statute says that the commissioner must make a reasonable effort to have the case evaluated. I think a reasonable reading of that statute is the entire case. The entire case includes the additional evidence submitted before the ALJ, which in this case was very important because it was the Arizona long-term care assessment that found the child was at risk of institutionalization. The case involved the aunt's testimony, and I think that was very important. Even the ALJ said she was credible, and she identified a number of deficits that I think a medical expert would have looked at. It's also not enough that the non-examining state agency physicians reviewed this child's case at the initial and the reconsideration stages. Again, that was already provided for at the time the statute was enacted. If that was enough, then the statute would have no meaning. And I think it's the principle of statutory construction that it should not be interpreted in such a fashion.
There's no legislative history on this, is there?
I tried mightily to find anything at all, and I couldn't find a thing. Not a thing.
Because in this child, this was a cutback on the statute was a cutback, as I recall, on the benefits available. Isn't that correct? Overall.
Overall, I would agree with that. Yes.
But this does introduce the notion that there be a qualified pediatrician,
or other
qualified.
Right.
But I take it the argument is in case of child disabilities, Congress appears to have been focused on getting someone who's familiar with child diseases and development. So the other individual, is it enough if they are just someone who's experienced in dealing with psychiatric problems or rheumatoid arthritis or whatever it may be? It doesn't necessarily have to be a pediatrician, or do the people who testify evaluating the case have to be specifically qualified in childhood diseases?
That would certainly be my argument. For example, there are some mental aspects to this case. If the ALJ just called a psychologist, somebody with PhD after their name, I'd say, wait a minute, let's find out what kind of psychologist. And if that psychologist isn't a child psychologist or at least can't say, well, I've got experience in dealing with children, I would object. I would say the statute says appropriate specialist, and that's not an appropriate specialist. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay. There are a couple other things that I'm only going to touch on briefly because they're not the overall focus of the case. But the other problem with this case is the ALJ's selective analysis of the evidence. Most specifically, his failure to look at the Arizona long-term care evaluation that said this child was so impaired that she was at risk of institutionalization. Also, contrary to the ALJ's version of the facts, found that the child needed occupational, speech, and physical therapy. The other problem, again, just touching on it briefly, is that the ALJ was very unclear as to how he was reviewing this. As you just mentioned, Judge Fischer, there was a statutory change here. Yet the ALJ, not once, not twice, but three times, says he's reviewing this case as a continuing disability review for medical improvement. That has nothing to do with the statutory changes that you mentioned. At that point, then, unless there are further questions from the Court, I will reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Judge Gibson? Judge Gibson, any questions?
No questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, please, Court. My name is William Dawson, appearing on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. The appellant's argument that the Commissioner did not comply with the statute 42 U.S.C. Section 1382 CA3I is,
could you speak up a little? I can't hear you.
Okay. Is completely without merit. Here, appellant's case was evaluated by two state agency physicians. The state agency physicians basically take a look at the available medical evidence and determine whether or not the child meets, equals, or functionally equals the listings. Notably in this case, Dr. Kirshnevik is a pediatrician, as indicated by the AMA Medical Association, American Medical Association's website.
That's in the record?
That's not in the record.
Is that enough? I mean, the ALJ didn't evaluate him as an expert to evaluate the case per se, did he?
The ALJ did not.
You're just saying because there's these two folks, two doctors in the record, that's enough to meet the statute.
That's enough to meet the statute alone. In addition to that, the ALJ did send the child out to have a consultative psychological evaluation on two occasions, and this was done by Dr. Leonard on August 1997, and this is at excerpts of record 16 through 21, and she also evaluated him on April 1998, excerpts of record 27 through 31. Notably, Dr. Leonard is a specialist in child psychology. And this is indicated on her letterhead at excerpts of record 27, I believe. It says, Elizabeth L. Leonard, Director of Clinical and Neurobehavior Disorders, Child and Adult Psychology. Finally, the Commissioner was not obligated to consult other appropriate specialists, as the District Court found. The appellant was evaluated by numerous medical and non-medical specialists. She was evaluated by at least 11 separate specialists, a developmental psychologist, a child psychologist, a neuropsychological fellow, school psychologist, occupational therapist.
Okay, this is an issue that's troublesome to me because I do note that this statute cut back on benefits to children but did take the trouble to specify that it be a qualified pediatrician or other individual like knowledge to evaluate the case. And what I'm concerned about, although in this case there seem to have been a lot of doctors looking at this unfortunate young girl, that somehow the notion that the ALJs can satisfy the statute by saying, well, you know, they're examining or consulting doctors here who fit the category of having pediatric-type experience. So that's enough to satisfy the mandate of the statute. I don't find that an appealing reading of the statute. It doesn't seem consistent with what Congress had in mind, that they wanted an expert who would assist the ALJ, who's may not be familiar with the peculiarities of childhood diseases and the difficulties, instead of dealing
with...
Can I just finish?
Okay.
Because I'm really interested in getting your complete thoughts on this. That if the ALJ are going to start relying on the witnesses who are brought forward, that does not seem to be what the statute contemplates. It contemplates that the ALJ make an effort to get that expertise to help him or her evaluate the case. And that's why I'm concerned, even given the number of people you're listing here, that did those people really evaluate the case, or did they come in, as we so often see? We had a case yesterday where the surgeon looked at the woman's chronic sinus condition, but he was just looking at a narrow issue. Yes, he was an expert in sinusitis or whatever, but he wasn't there to evaluate the full picture. And you all were arguing, your administration was arguing, well, you know, there's not enough evidence to support there. So how do we assure that the ALJs actually treat this congressional mandate seriously?
Usually, you're right, you're correct. When the ALJ does send the claimant out for an evaluation, it is usually just a snapshot at that point in time. On some occasions, the evaluators are able to review some of the medical evidence of record, and they usually indicate that. So sometimes they might evaluate the case. But the way the commissioner usually has doctors evaluate the case is at the initial reconsideration levels of review. And in this case, the statute is worded in a way that it's not necessarily the ALJ has to have a medical specialist evaluate the case. It says the commissioner shall make reasonable efforts. And it seems that the intent of the statute is to make sure that there is at least a doctor, evaluate the case. Because sometimes a claimant may come forward and not have any medical evidence. They might just have, just a couple reports from occupational therapists or speech therapists or, lay witness reports. And this is a way to ensure that you at least have a physician, an appropriate specialist, evaluate the case. And that's what happened in this case. The claimant was, the case was evaluated by two state agency physicians.
And they came in at what stage?
They came in at the initial and reconsideration levels of review. In this case, it's a redetermination case. They determined the case over again. And it was Dr. Kirschvick evaluated the case in September 1997. And Kirshner evaluated the case about a year later in May 1998. Dr. Kirschvinick's specialty is not indicated in the record, but I did some research on the American Medical Association's website, which indicates he is a pediatrician in this case.
I'm all for the website, but how do we substantiate what's floating out around on the website as to whether it's accurate or not? Or do we just take that on faith?
You can take it upon judicial notice. If you'd like, I could make a motion for that.
Judicial notice of somebody's...
You better start to cite some authority for me.
Somebody's credentials.
We'll start getting those on Doebert motions, and we're in big trouble. So.
Okay, plaintiff or appellant also argues that... That the standard in this case wasn't necessarily clear, but the ALJ indicated that he did redetermine appellant's case under Public Law 104-193. He did mention the continuing disability review procedures in his decision, but he also specifically stated that the case is being redetermined under Public Law 104 at excerpts of record 75, 73, and also 84. In his final findings, he also indicated that he redetermined the case under Public Law 104-193.
That may be true, but as we heard in a different context today, a judicial officer can make statements that push the right buttons, but substantively do something quite different. And the concern one has when the ALJ repeatedly cites the wrong process, he may invoke the statute, but how do we know he wasn't really applying a different standard, even though he invoked the right statutory
Well, he did.
Authority.
In this case, the substance of the decision indicates that it was a redetermination decision. He looked at all the evidence since she was found disabled, indicated that the evidence did indicate some improvement in this decision. In this case, because it was redetermination, he didn't have to find that there was an improvement in her condition, because under the new statute, he was more stringent. It was more stringent to become disabled. He just went through the new functional domains and indicated that there was some improvement, but under the new standard, she didn't meet equal or functionally equal to the listings.
Okay. All right. Judge Gibson, do you have any further questions?
Oh, I'm asking up for a little while.
Okay.
Judge, there are a few points I want to make. I'm really not happy about hearing about extra record evidence at the time of oral argument, especially when it wasn't in the brief. But I don't think that's important. What's important is the administrative law judge in this case did not even mention the state agency physicians in his opinion. They didn't even exist as far as that opinion was concerned. Yet the commissioner is saying that that satisfies the statute's requirement. Not only is that legally incorrect in terms of what I believe would be the reasonable intent of Congress, it's certainly factually incorrect under the facts of this case. But let's look at what the commissioner just said. The state agency physicians reviewed the available medical evidence. Everything in this case was not available to those physicians. In particular, the commissioner relies upon Dr. Leonard's second evaluation. At excerpts of record 30, Dr. Johnson says this child should be sent out for a neurological evaluation. At excerpts of record 38 through 39, we have that neurological evaluation that Dr. Leonard never saw. A physician who had testified at the hearing would have had both of those items of evidence available to him or her to evaluate the case, and that, I think, is very important. The only other point I want to make is about this standard of review by the ALJ, rather, and that is that it's hard for me to understand how the commissioner can say, well, this business about medical improvement wasn't important because he also cited the statute, when the ALJ himself in his decision mentions that improvement is part of the reason for why he's making the decision that he's making. Under this Court's case in Holohan and the Eighth Circuit's case in Goode, that would not necessarily carry the day in and of itself. But the point is, it certainly is a matter of concern regarding what the ALJ, as you mentioned, Judge Fischer, had in his mind. Are there any other questions from the panel?
Chris, I would be interested in your take on the statutory provision that says that the commissioner shall make reasonable efforts to ensure that a qualified pediatrician or other individual who specialize in a field of medicine appropriate for the disability of the individual evaluates the case of this individual. Does that mean that there has to be one person testifying at the hearing that sums it all up, or can it be the evaluation other individual who specializes in the field is evaluating what those disabilities are?
As a practical matter, I mean, I'm in the trenches. I'm a practitioner doing this. ALJs call medical experts to come into the hearing. I mean, that's just how it's done. I've never seen it done in any other way. Some ALJs call a medical expert every single case, which I approve of. Could there be a different way of doing it? The answer is yes. An ALJ could bundle up the whole record and send it off to an expert and say, you know, here's a list of interrogatories and send me a copy of them and allow me to respond, and, you know, we could go down that road. As a practical matter, I think that's more difficult than having an expert actually come into the hearing where you can cross-examine them and get it all done at once. But this case illustrates an important point, though. The ALJ found that Sherry Howard, the aunt, was credible, and she listed a whole bunch of things that I think, as I already said, justify reversal and remand for award of benefits under Schneider. But having said that, if you just bundled up the documents themselves and sent them to a medical expert and said, here they are, read them and give me your opinion, that still wouldn't substitute for what I believe is the more helpful route of being there and listening to the witness testifying. And as so often actually happens in these cases, medical experts saying to the judge, do you mind if I ask a question?
You're suggesting that this medical expert would sit through the entire proceedings?
That is how it's done in practice in Phoenix, where I practice, and I think that's the better way for it to happen. But to answer Judge Hugg's question directly, does the statute actually require that? No, I don't think so.
I would just, because the magistrate judge who reviewed all this made an extremely thorough evaluation of all the various people, probably more so than the administrative law judge did.
I agree.
And I'm just curious of whether that would be enough to comply with the statute.
Okay, the answer to that is absolutely no. Even though the magistrate judge, this guy did a very good job, I agree with you, doesn't substitute for what the ALJ did. It's the ALJ who has to make the decision. But two, it's not enough to say here are all of the evaluations as a judge, whether it be an ALJ or a magistrate judge or any other judge, and then turn around and say, well, here's my medical judgment as to whether this child meets or equals the medical criteria in the listing of impairments. And I have this rather horrendous footnote in my brief about ALJs acting as their own expert witnesses, and that certainly would be my point in response to that question.
Okay. All right. Judge Gibson, any further questions?
No questions.
All right. The case just argued will be submitted. Thank counsel for their arguments, and we will stand adjourned. Don't break that gavel.
Scared me.
As a judge, whether it be an ALJ or a magistrate judge or any other judge, and then turn around and say, well, here's my medical judgment as to whether this child meets or equals the medical criteria in the listing of impairments. And I have this rather horrendous footnote in my brief about ALJs acting as their own expert witnesses, and that certainly would be my point in response to that question.
Okay. All right. Judge Gibson, any further questions?
No questions.
All right. The case just argued will be submitted. Thank counsel for their arguments, and we will stand adjourned.
Wow.
Don't break that gavel.
Scared me.